headlines, Brazilian police retake control of key governmental buildings, including the Congress. Israel revokes the travel cards of a foreign minister of Palestine in response to the Palestinians' move to ask for the opinion of the UN court. And China carries out naval and air drills around Taiwan in a second such maneuvers in less than a month. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Brazil's Supreme Court has suspended the governor of the capital, Brasilia, for 90 days, a day after three government buildings were stormed by supporters of far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro. The Supreme Court cited security flaws that allowed the invasion of the court building, as well as the presidential palace and the Congress. The court also gave Bolsonaro's supporters 24 hours to remove the camps that they set up outside military bases. Hundreds of the ex-president's supporters have been arrested in the aftermath of the Sunday attacks. Bolsonaro has condemned the attack, but he is being blamed for triggering it by disputing the outcome of the October presidential elections, which he lost to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The incumbent now says those who invaded the government buildings are fanatical fascists.
Like true vandals destroying what they found in front of them. We think there was a lack of security, and I wanted to tell you that all those people who did this will be found and punished. And these people, these vandals, what could we say, are fanatical Nazis, fanatical fascists, did what has never been done in this country.
Lula, who took office just over a week ago, declared a federal security intervention to restore law and order in the capital. The raid on the government buildings has drawn a chorus of condemnations from world leaders, including from several American countries and the European Council. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Camila Escalante, says police in Brazil have been accused of aiding protesters during the course of the recent unrest in the country.
President Lula, as well as the president of the Workers' Party right away, said that the Brasilia District Police failed to do their job. They failed to dismantle these so-called protests or riots that were taking place. In some cases, the police officers were seen and photographed speaking to, chatting with the rioters, taking selfies, taking photos with them. And some people reported, some people who actually participated in the destruction of these buildings said that the police were actually aiding them. But after the announcements were made on social media, a little bit of action began to be taken. Some arrests have been made, of course. At this hour, they say 300 arrests have been made, but that's because of the federal intervention. Lula came on television from where he was here in a town in the interior of Sao Paulo. He had been visiting that town because of heavy rains and destruction, which had led to several deaths there. So he was not in the capital today. And he decreed federal intervention in Brasilia, which means that the military is able to go and deal with the rioters and what they call terrorism and insurrection by fascists there. And so what also might come of this is the dismantling of some of the camps where these people have been supposedly protesting.
The United States President Joe Biden has visited the nation's southern border to get a firsthand account of the refugee crisis snowballing by the hour. But this comes as Joe Biden has just expanded a controversial Trump-era policy which allows for more deportations of asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahiri reports from Chicago.
United States President Joe Biden has visited the Mexican border for just the first time in his presidency. An estimated 8,000 asylum seekers cross the Texas border every day, with last year breaking records.
Official data showed that the number of undocumented immigrant crossings at the southwest border reached 2.8 million people, breaking the annual record by more than 1 million.
In yet another major expansion of a policy of Donald Trump, which the Democratic Party criticized for years, Biden announced the U.S. will immediately deport even more new arrivals. Biden has also drastically increased the number of deportations from the Trump era. The United States accepts fewer refugees per capita than almost any other Western nation, and the world's wealthiest country refuses to provide adequate resettlement and border services.
Let's not forget that the Biden administration still is running the very same for-profit internment camps on the southern border that are full of immigrants. When Trump was president, there was rightfully a lot of criticism of these policies. These are not just holding cells or whatever. These are basically internment camps where large numbers of immigrants, including families and children, are held.
Rarely discussed in the mainstream media is that U.S. foreign policy has played a major role in the Western Hemisphere's long-running refugee crisis. Instead, both the media and Biden's immigration policy give special priority to asylum seekers leaving socialist-inspired nations, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua.
Encouraging them to leave these countries that have socialist governments. And then, of course, the U.S. government says, look at these people fleeing so-called communism. It's exactly what the Biden administration's spokespeople have been saying. It's basically, you know, right-wing Cold War-style propaganda. And the reality is that these people are not fleeing. These people are going to the United States because the U.S. is telling them, we're going to give you visas.
2022 saw seemingly the entire West accused of racism due to their privileging of refugees from Ukraine over non-white asylum seekers. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Israel has suspended a VIP pass of the Palestinian foreign minister Riyad al-Maliki that could hinder his travel in and around the occupied West Bank. That is in response to the Palestinians' bid to involve the International Court of Justice in their conflict with the Israeli regime. Israeli forces confiscated al-Maliki's card while he was entering from Jordan. Israel's new right-wing cabinet has announced a series of measures after the UN General Assembly responded to a Palestinian appeal asking the ICJ for an opinion on the legal status of Israel's occupation of Palestine. The regime's measures, including using Palestinian money to compensate Israelis killed or injured in Palestinian operations, has also imposed a moratorium on Palestinian constructions. Separately, an Israeli minister who recently stormed into Al-Aqsa Mosque has directed troops to remove Palestinian flags from public spaces. Now, that happened after a long-serving Palestinian prisoner waved a flag while receiving a hero's welcome upon his release. Israel also revoked the VIP cards of three senior Palestinian officials for paying a visit to the freed inmate. Iranian people and officials are reacting to a French magazine's insulting Muslim sanctities and the country's religious and national values. President Ebrahim Raisi has condemned the sacrilegious act, saying that resorting to insults under the pretext of freedom indicates the West's despair and failure in the recent riots that they fought in Iran. Also, Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani recommended French authorities follow the basic principles of international law, that is, mutual respect and honoring religious values of other countries. Meanwhile, Iranian people have rallied in the cities of Tehran and Qom to denounce the move. The demonstrators in front of the French embassy slammed the Paris government for double standards in dealing with such insults. The French weekly Charlie Hebdo has published cartoons of Iran's religious and political authorities. The infamous magazine has a record of insulting the Prophet of Islam as well. An official ceremony has been organized in Damascus to mark the third assassination anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. He was the commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Mohammad Ali reports.
Syrian, Iranian, Palestinian, and Yemeni officials have gathered in Damascus to pay tribute to the commander of Iran's Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria said the ceremony is aimed at renewing allegiance to the thoughts of General Soleimani, who foiled Western plots in the region.
What humiliated the U.S. in Western Asia was Iran and the Resistance Alliance. General Soleimani played a great role in foiling U.S. plots and changing the balance of power in the interest of the people of the region. Iran's regional power in West Asia in the past two decades was a result of Soleimani's strategic thinking.
We express our gratitude to a man who considers Syria a priority and worked for a bright future for the people of the region based on cooperation. Syria will not forget this man, and his life will inspire all those who want the best for their nations.
Soleimani's sacrifices and heroism will remain alive in the memory of Syrians and free people of the world. His path will inspire many generations to come.
Speakers recall General Soleimani's significant efforts in countering the plots of Western powers and their proxies in the region, primarily his role in supporting Palestinian resistance against the Israeli enemy.
General Soleimani had a great role in supporting Palestinian resistance factions, but in providing arms and training or planning in the face of Israeli aggression. He supported our people in repelling all Israeli attacks in 2008, 2009, 2012, and 2014.
Anthems praising the resistance and General Soleimani were chanted during the event. The ceremony also included an exhibition showcasing various stages of General Soleimani's life, quotes, and battles against terrorism. For over a week, Syrians organized many events to commemorate General Soleimani's achievements in Syria in a show of respect to a commander who stood beside them during their hardships and played a key role in eliminating terrorism almost in every inch of Syria's territory. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
China has carried out naval and air drills around Taiwan, the second such maneuvers in less than a month, as tensions remain high in the region. The Chinese military says the exercises were aimed at testing combat readiness and counter the provocative actions of external or Taiwan separatist forces. The Taiwanese Defense Ministry says 28 aircrafts were detected over its defense zone, among other military units operating around the island. China considers self-ruled Taiwan as its own territory and vows to take it back by force if necessary. Taiwan has been a source of contention between China and the U.S. for years now. The U.S. continues to supply arms to the island. Beijing says Washington's assistance emboldens Taipei in its independence push. The island has been expanding cooperation with Washington despite warnings from Beijing. And hundreds of Rohingya refugees in India are still deprived of proper shelter as freezing weather hits parts of the country. The poor community now has to face both the terrible weather conditions and acute sickness spread among its members. Munawar Saman reports.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy which treats refugees equally. regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere after fleeing Myanmar. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, in the outskirts of New Delhi.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
Taxi! Taxi! My destination is Bandar Turkaman Pier. Thank you. Watching migrating birds has always been attractive to me. This season of the year is perfect for the birds migrating from the north to this island. I mean, Ashurada Island. It's one of the wonders of the nature, the way a flock of birds fly and move together. Ashurada Island is a perfect place for birds, seagulls, flamingos, pheasants, because this island is uninhabited. Iranian northern coastline is characterized with its unique, pristine nature, a combination of sea and forest. Being extended from Astara on the far west of Caspian Sea to Bandar Turkaman on its far east, it is a 660-kilometer-long coastline. Throughout the Caspian Sea southern coastline, there is only one Iranian island, Ashuradeh. Being 40 kilometers to the west of Gorgan, capital of Golestan province, the island is a part of Miankale Peninsula. The total area of the island used to be 1,200 hectares, 800 hectares of which has submerged into the Caspian Sea. Being 26 meters below sea level, it is a mild climate island, 5 kilometers west of Bandar Turkaman. During its heyday, the locals used to do animal husbandry, bakery, and fishery. But after the island was flooded in 1993, the locals migrated to Bandar Turkaman. Being registered as a natural reserve, it is a befitting natural habitat for the region wilderness. Being so, there is a wide range of animal species in the region. Its vegetation includes raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees, to name a few, and its wilderness consists of fox, jackal, rabbit, fish, seabirds, pheasants, and partridge. It is worth mentioning that the region accounts for 40% of Iranian caviar fishing. Under Soviet seas in the First World War, some hospitals, residences, fortresses were constructed in the island. Through the passage of time, only one fort has remained and has been registered as a national heritage. Here's the Bandar Turkaman Pier. I have to take a boat and take a tour to Ashurada Island. It's about 10 minutes. The boatman is ready and we set off. Ashurade has a great history. It's registered internationally as one of the natural reserves in the world. It's also one of the most important wetlands in the world. A perfect natural habitat for the region's wilderness. I'm going to visit the Triangle Fortress and then I'll pay a visit to Myankale Wetland. It's interesting to note that during the safari period, this island was a hunting ground, while during the Qajari period, this island became the starting point and destination of commercial ships. Boats usually dock at the side of the wooden bridge and we have to pass over it to reach the island. At the first look, you can understand that how special this island's vegetation is. Raspberry bushes, sour pomegranate trees. Wow, unique, very special. Some historical documents indicate that palm trees, cotton, and sugarcane were also grown in this island. And here I am, near the Triangle Fortress. It used to be a military fortress in the past, with three watchtowers. The entrance of the fortress has an arched facade made of bricks. I call it oral history. It doesn't have a very special decoration since it's a military fortress. Let me walk inside. It has almost 11 chambers, very old. And it has been registered in the list of National Heritage Sites. Oh, I can also see the fortresses built during the Safavid era from this point. Great! Did you know that how pristine this island has remained? I have a great feeling here. Just listen. The sound of waves that reach the coast is really comforting. And look at those sand hills. They're so untouched. Wow, look at them. We have a lot of guests. I'm talking about the migrating birds. Thank you. And in the last part of my trip, I have come to Myankale Wetland. Myankale Wetland is actually a heaven for the migrating birds, flying from different parts of the world. Listen. Wow. The best music. The sun is about to set, and I feel happy to be here in this beautiful Iranian island.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
On January 3, 2020, former U.S. President Donald Trump directly ordered drone strikes that killed Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy commander of Iraq's Hashd al-Shaabi anti-terror force. 5 days later, Operation Qasem Soleimani. Iran retaliated by firing dozens of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base in al-Anbar Governorate, western Iraq, as well as another U.S. air base in Erbil, declaring that the attacks were part of his promised tough revenge for the assassination. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look back at that day, Iran's bold and courageous move, and how Iran's revenge from the U.S. is not over. First, let me introduce our guests. Saad al-Mutalabi, Iraqi politician, joins us from Baghdad. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Saad al-Mutalabi. Obviously, you're familiar with this incident, and it's the third anniversary of this ballistic missile attack against the Ain al-Assad air base. But tell us what you thought when that happened. What went through your mind?
Yes, thank you very much. Well, we were expecting. Everybody were expecting retaliation, a hard retaliation by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I think the Americans also. From the information we gathered that the Americans knew or were expecting such an attack on their bases, therefore they, to minimize their casualties, they would not congregate in one area, they were spread around the camp, and they've actually dug new trenches where they were sleeping the night, as they have explained after the attack. And so we were all expecting the attack, but I was very surprised at the severity of the attack. We did not expect that amount of missiles and the accuracy of the missiles that were used were definitely a surprise to us and naturally to the Americans, who were the target of the strikes. We felt that it is a sign, or it is a first step. But I'm sure, as you very well know and everybody knows, this will not compensate for the martyrdom of Abu Mahdi Mohandes and, of course, General Soleimani. But as you know and we accept that if we are murdered by the Westerner forces, the non-believers, this is automatically a martyrdom. So there's no regret on that. Uh-huh. But the regret is that we have not yet managed to gain the vengeance, or at least to see justice served to those who were responsible for this atrocity against our leaders. But as you asked, yes, we were expecting, but of course it was a big surprise at the amount and the accuracy of those missiles.
We're going to talk about those missiles a little later down in the program. But Zafar Bangash, you know, when you have this predicament that Iran faced after, obviously, the assassination of Qasem Soleimani and Mahdi Mohandes, there are lots of options that I'm sure that was on the table. Of course, what I'm asking you is perhaps kind of tough to maybe respond to. But given the variety of options that Iran had decide on, what do you think about the option that it finally rested on and then executed, and, of course, the result that it had?
Well, first of all, before I address that question, I would like to put this whole issue into its proper legal context. The attack that Trump had ordered for the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and his comrade Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, it was a war crime. In fact, at that time, the UN Special Rapporteur for Extrajudicial Killings, Agnes Callamard, in her report submitted to the Security Council in July of 2020, she clearly stated that it was a war crime, that General Qasem Soleimani was a senior official, he was on a diplomatic mission, and therefore this constituted a war crime. I also want to remind your viewers that according to Chapter 7, Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, it clearly states that if a member of the United Nations is subjected to aggression, illegal aggression, as this was from the United States, then the victim party has the right to carry out retaliation in whatever way it deems necessary. So we need to keep these two points in mind and then look at the response of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which obviously was within its right and within its power to carry out that missile strike at the two military bases, in particular, an al-Assad military base in Anbar province. And what is absolutely incredible is that this was the first time in contemporary history that any country has been able to carry out such a retaliatory strike against the United States. If we look at the situation, for instance, in Ukraine today, the U.S. is supplying all kinds of weapons to Ukraine. In fact, missiles that the Ukrainians are using against military bases in Russia. And although Russia has warned that it is going to retaliate against the United States, but it has not done so, although Russia is supposed to be a superpower. So in fact, what the Islamic Republic of Iran did was to break that psychological barrier in hitting the United States forces and hitting them hard. But as your guest pointed out, that's not the final thing. There's going to be other retaliations coming through. And of course, we can talk about it as we proceed in the program. But definitely, this was a major, major psychological breakthrough that the Islamic Republic of Iran achieved, and therefore set an example for other countries that they can take retaliatory action against this rogue regime that is the United States.
You know, when that happened, when this attack did take place, Saddam al-Talabi, there was somewhat of an underestimation that also took place. Because initially, if you remember, the former U.S. President Donald Trump came out and said it was no big deal. We didn't suffer anything. It was just maybe some minor injuries that happened. And somewhat of a symbolic act is the type of impression that he was trying to give off. But obviously, there was a lot more to it. Let's talk about the missiles, which obviously the Americans knew that Iranians had. But they underestimated the power, because looking at the facts, it was the largest missile attack. But in terms of the missile firepower, upwards of 1,100 pounds of high explosive were these missiles in terms of their capability, and of which this U.S. base or any U.S. base cannot withstand a direct hit from these missiles, the name Fateh 313. So how was it that that was something that the U.S. underestimated, given Iran's power in its missile capability?
I think the United States underestimated Iran's power in many issues, not only the missiles. And the biggest underestimation was with the accuracy. To make big bombs, that's easy. You know, you make a big tube and you put a lot of TNT in it, and that's it. But to make it accurate, that is the hard part. And to make it fly for hundreds, or thousands, I don't know, hundreds of kilometers to a target which is the size of a blanket, and hit that blanket from so many hundreds of kilometers away, that requires an extreme accuracy. And that was definitely showed by this attack. And they weren't concentrated in one area, they were concentrated on all over the camp, in the end resulted to the almost total destruction of the camp. And so the amount of power these missiles had was incredible. And it's obvious that the Americans did not want to escalate further. Because as you very correctly said, Mr. Trump, the president, came out and underestimated the whole event. And as if it was like, children throwing stones or something like that. Because he knew that his forces were not able in defending themselves against the Islamic Republic by the numbers and the forces they had in the region. And they would definitely suffer further destruction if they were to re-escalate the issue.
Yes, Zafar Bangash, you mentioned how this has never happened before. I'm going to take a direct quote from the then Army Major Robert Hayes, who was the top doctor at Ain al-Assad, who said, quote, "It has never happened in history that a ground force has been exposed to 11 theater ballistic missiles." And to further add to that, just a couple of testimonials, two U.S. officers, they said that the strikes caused the shelter's doors to bend like waves. And another saying that the old videos of Hiroshima, where the bright light came after it exploded and the cloud and the brightness showed itself, are just a couple of the testimonials here. Now, I'm not trying to promote the use of the missile, but the Iran's missile capability and the effect that it had, which to what statement that you made, it kind of breaks that invincibility that the U.S. Army perhaps has with this attack. What then can come out of that when the invincibility has been broken, of in this case, the Islamic Republic, making the courageous decision to attack the U.S. military base?
Well, to reiterate once again, the accuracy of the missiles of the Islamic Republic, I mean, it was actually pinpoint accuracy. The entire infrastructure, the barracks and the bases, etc., at Ain al-Assad were totally obliterated. And this is a remarkable achievement by the Islamic Republic of Iran. In addition to that, as you pointed out, initially, Donald Trump tried to sort of downplay the impact of this strike by saying, well, we didn't suffer any casualties, etc. But later on, it emerged that there were at least 100 American forces that were moved to hospitals in Kuwait who were receiving, they had suffered serious concussions, serious trauma, and they were receiving treatment in Kuwaiti hospitals. This was even admitted by an American general by the name of General Shaw, Major General Shaw. He said that, you know, our American forces did suffer those casualties. So first of all, it was the pinpoint accuracy of Iran's missiles. Secondly, the blows that were inflicted on the Americans. And third, that psychological barrier that has been broken because America got a message that the Islamic Republic of Iran is capable and willing to be able to take action against any aggression that is imposed against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we saw that, you know, after that, Trump basically in downplaying the significance of this retaliation, clearly did not want to escalate the situation because he knew that the American forces are going to suffer massive casualties if Trump attempted to do that. So in that sense, I think it is a very important breakthrough in terms of contemporary warfare. And it shows that the Islamic Republic of Iran is not only capable, but it has a leadership that is courageous and is prepared to stand up for its rights and not be bullied into submissions, as so many other countries, unfortunately, have been done. So I think this is a new paradigm. It's a paradigm shift, actually, in modern warfare. And we see now that America is gradually moving out of the region, which, of course, should be the ultimate objective of the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well as all other forces that are fighting against foreign interference, foreign aggression. So I think that process has already started, and it started with, Iran's courageous stand against the aggression that America had perpetrated. And obviously, this is not the end of it. It needs to continue in different ways, but I'm sure that the Islamic Republic decision makers will determine that as to when what the appropriate time is and what is the best way to do that.
Indeed. Let's take a look at now the impact that this has had in terms of the U.S. calculations. Saddam al-Talabi. So we're looking at this Ain al-Assad base, which is a huge base from what we understand. I mean, it takes about half hour to go from one end to the other. And you have this attack that's taken place. And then you have, as our guest there, Zafar Bangash, mentioned, and I'm sure you're well aware, that up to 100 U.S. soldiers suffered some major injuries, basically head traumas, concussions, etc. And also the fact that these U.S. soldiers, they weren't even safe when they went and hid in the bunker, which shows the vulnerability of the base when it comes to these missiles. So my question then is, doesn't that cause then a major shift to at a minimum, but rather it puts the U.S. in a dilemma? If their base cannot be safe from a missile attack, and in this case from Iran, then they have to change their calculations. How do you think that impacted their view militarily when it comes to a U.S. base, and in this case in Iraq, and maybe in other parts of West Asia?
Yeah, that's why they spent billions and billions of dollars on finding new ways in combating or trying to stop missiles and intercepting flying missiles into their bases. And since 2020, as I said, billions and billions of dollars were poured into technological companies in trying to find workable methods to stop missiles falling on them. But regardless of that, is the actual event, the actual act of attacking these missiles, which created this ripple effect that people previously, we all thought that the Americans would be invincible and their bases, nobody would be able to get close to their bases. And even if they did, maybe with a small, small artillery or indirect fire, mortars or something like that. But to have this amount of accurate missiles falling on the base, that was definitely a large surprise and a shock to the Americans and to the world. That showed the amount of power that the Islamic Republic can wield at will and can deliver with tremendous accuracy into the American bases. The Americans definitely are taking a less aggressive role now in Iraq and taking a back seat in events. They do move diplomatically, politically, but as a presence of their military forces, we see very, very little amount of movement militarily, air support or ground support. We don't see any American presence now a few years since that event. I personally haven't seen any American soldier in Iraq since that incident. So the Americans have definitely diverted their attention in Iraq more away from military intervention into a diplomatic effort, and that is possibly a positive outcome. But still, you know, the Americans, their diplomacy is not easy. We definitely need to know that their interference could be very negative in events here in Iraq.
Safra Bangash, the U.S. calculations and their approach and military strategy, obviously, it stems from their maneuverability when it comes to their bases. When their bases are fragile, in this case, in point again, because of these missiles, it has to have an impact as to how they are going to approach any militaristic adventurism that they may have, whether it's inside of Iraq or in other countries in the region. Do you think that had an impact on that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it had a tremendous impact because if we look at it, and to reiterate, number one, the Americans did not, you know, escalate this issue. They had to back down by downplaying the significance of the Iranian missile retaliatory strike, because they knew that if they escalated this, that they are going to suffer, number one. Secondly, and I would like to link this with the American defeat in Afghanistan as well, which occurred, of course, about a year and a half that they had to run away from Afghanistan. And despite the fact that America claims to be a superpower, it has, and there is no doubt that it has enormous destructive power at its disposal, that it has a lot of weapons, etc., that it can cause a lot of damage in the country. And yet it was forced to flee from Afghanistan because it saw that despite all of its weapons, it is not able to subdue the people over there. And this was a development in the entire region. In fact, you know, if you look at some of the Arab regimes immediately after Iran's strikes on these two American military bases, both Qatar and the UAE sent their, you know, representative, the UAE sent its foreign minister to Iran to tell them that, you know, as far as UAE is concerned, it is not involved in it and it doesn't want to, you know, escalate this. It had nothing to do with it. And similarly with the Qataris, they sent their representatives to tell the Islamic Republic of Iran that they had nothing to do with the American strikes and they would like to keep out of it. So this had a tremendous ripple effect in the entire region. And I think this needs to spread further in order to drive America's intrusive actions in that region. These are destabilizing. These are not in the interests of the people. And once the Americans are driven out of the region completely, then I think it would be possible for the Muslims to deal with that other illegitimate entity, the Zionist regime. So we look forward to that day when that would happen.
Okay. Now let's talk about Iraq a little bit. And Saad Motalebi, who better than to ask you this question? I mean, when you take a look at Iraq, what happened with Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mohandas in terms of the assassination that took place, the U.S. Made a decision to do that in Iraqi soil. And so many times Iran has mentioned the destabilizing, impact that the U.S. has by its presence in Iraq. But Iraq's sovereignty, its territorial integrity, was violated by the decision that the U.S. made. And hence Iran, and I believe Iran did inform the Iraqi government, went ahead and took the decision to do what it did in terms of attacking Ain al-Assad. in the way that it did. But Iraq's sovereignty was first violated by the U.S. Didn't that lead to Iraqi politicians, lawmakers, and the government to then really go ahead and want U.S. to leave their country?
Oh, definitely. Yes, there were a tremendous amount of demonstrations and violence and against the towards the American presence in Baghdad and in Iraq in general, and there were a tremendous amount of pressure. The parliament voted for the immediate removal of all American forces from Iraq, but the government at the time could not, and then Mr. Kadhimi came, who was probably, I don't know, the investigation is still going on. He could be involved in this. He could, maybe he's not. I don't know. They still, we are waiting for the evidence to be declared. But the people feeling in general was, the anger was absolutely tremendous. And the people were, and the parliament and all government organizations, they were calling for the Americans to leave the country immediately. But of course, you know, the amount of pressure that was exerted on the, at that time, the government. I mean, I remember the prime minister at the time, Adel Abdel Mahdi, he came to the parliament and asked the parliament, please vote to get the Americans out. And the parliament took that brave decision and voted for the removal of the American forces. And the numbers were reduced tremendously. I think 3,000 immediately had to leave the country. And what the remaining forces now is really just administrators and a number of trainers.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Saad al-Mutalabi there from Baghdad, Iraqi politician. Thank you. Zafar Bangash, a pleasure, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atal, the host of this program. Within the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qum, Shaykh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh.
Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. I'm very happy to be here.
You're welcome. Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammadpour, with the developments that we see in the modern world today, we could see that divinity and the position of God is lost in the lives of the people. And this is mostly because of the progress and development in the scientific matters, up to an extent that some people say there is no need to God, or God has done its duty. Now it is our time as human beings to, we can say, be the most important entity or deity in the world as the human beings. So what's your answer to that? The modern people, especially with all these developments, do not need Allah or God at all?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And of course, we see the consequence of this idea in this modern life.